Hi everyone, it's Lydia here. I am so excited to bring you this episode and this guest. It's honestly, I had so much joy editing this. I was like, it's such an amazing story and there's so many like highs and lows. And honestly, I was just hooked in editing it, even though obviously I was in the room recording it. We're going to go on a journey, which is such a culmination of different topics that we've talked about in Weird Years episodes. To start it off, this is a story about really unpicking our childhood and the impact that it's had on us and kind of working through that in these years. It's really a story that pays homage to that you will evolve so much throughout your 20s and your 30s, and that whatever has happened in the past, there really is so much room for growth and reinvention of yourself. And ultimately, that it's really never too late to change your life and change the path that you're going down. And lastly, it's also a stark reminder that no matter what you think you've got in the future coming for you, no matter what your planning is, no matter what you presume the next 5, 10, 15 years of your life will look like, life can have a funny way of throwing things at you that you could not prepare for and you would absolutely not expect at this age. Really, I guess it's a learning and a reminder that we don't actually ever know what is coming. And all we can do in these years is react and roll with the punches and try to find a way to still live through this. This is Abby's story about her journey with addiction in her 20s and 30s and how she eventually got on the route to recovery. In this episode, we do talk about drug addiction and alcohol addiction. There's also themes of suicide mentioned throughout the episode. We talk about mental health and we talk about a devastating health diagnosis. Definitely decide if this is appropriate for you and listen with discretion. But also I want to make very clear, this is not an episode of doom and gloom and reciting misery. And that's really not what it's about. It's very much about reflection and change and evolution within her story. And ultimately finding hope at points where you might feel like it is a hopeless situation. From being a rebellious teenager, using alcohol to drown out her feelings and her internal struggles with herself, to moving to Thailand and relying on hard drugs whilst spending time over there working, but also really doing a lot of partying, to going to Canada, where ultimately she ends up trying crystal meth. She eventually is hospitalized and sectioned, and it starts to put her on the road back to recovery. This is a story of how, after all of that, she does get into therapy and she starts to rebuild her life. And only by digging up her kind of deepest, darkest trauma does she really move into a state of recovery from addiction. But then, just when life is starting to look up, when she has her addiction under control, when she's had diagnoses for her mental health, feeling a level of stability, she's an amazing man and really is putting the building blocks together of her life, she gets a devastating diagnosis that nobody would expect, and especially not in her mid-30s. Something you'll realise from the very beginning of this episode is that Abby is absolutely hilarious. And if you've come across her social media, you'll know this already, but she's really, really funny. And she tells this story, which obviously has some horrendous lows as well as some highs, but some horrendous lows and some really shocking turns. And she tells it with just such humor and lightness. And what I found was interesting is it's not this kind of surface level humor as if she's trying to throw you off the story. It's still told with a lot of raw emotion and grit and vulnerability. She's not using the humor to hide her pain. It's almost baked into just how she starts to view life. I think you'll also find a lot of parallels, even though the story maybe is very, very different to your own. There will be a lot of parallels of having to kind of dig in and do the deep work in order to know yourself better, in order to be kinder to yourself, and ultimately to move forward in your life. And you'll also probably see a lot of similarities in your own life when it comes to just being thrown a curveball that you could not have expected. And I think our 30s throw a lot of those, and having to adapt and work out how to live in that new reality. And if you do enjoy this episode, you enjoy the podcast in general, please do make sure that you're following wherever you're listening. If you're on Spotify and you're able to give a 5-star review, it really does go a long way. Please do share this to anyone that you think will also find value in the podcast. And I would always, as always, love to hear your thoughts. My DMs are always open. The comment section is always open. I would love to hear from you. Anyway, that is enough from me. This is honestly a golden episode and you're really going to enjoy it. And you're probably going to absolutely fall in love with Abby. She's brilliant. So let's get into it.
If life feels like a whirlwind of clarity and confusion, pull up a chair. Welcome to The Weird Years.
Well, Abby, welcome to the beige couch.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm very much feeling this outfit. It's giving me like very rock vibes.
Yeah, cheers. So like I don't think I've created this, right? But I've been doing this thing and I call it inner teenager healing.
Oh my God.
Right. So I've just got like naturally I've started like reverting back to my teenage thing. So I'm dressing really grungy, listening to really heavy music, watching all the TV shows that I used to love when I was a teenager. And it's like connecting myself with that teenage version of me who is very angry and angsty and needs a bit of love.
Oh my God, that's such a good idea.
Yeah.
Out of interest, were you one of those kids who had like a scrapbook and like, did you paint? Were you really creative when you were younger?
I was creative, but I'll tell you what, I was chronically online when I was a teenager. I taught myself how to build websites when I was like 12.
Oh my God.
So I was very creative.
She's a genius. But
I was very creative in that respect, but I didn't do like art or anything. But I used to like retreat into this online world and then, yeah, kind of express myself through website design and like journaling online and all this kind of stuff.
God, that's so much cooler than like whenever I go back to my mum's every now and then I'll dig out my like art books and they're always like about some guy in a band who like wouldn't even look at me and I'm like, I'm in love with you. I would never feel this way about anyone. And then I love looking back at them.
Yeah, I have a lot of diaries, but say stuff that's similar, but also I hate the world. Nobody understands me. Nothing will ever get better.
I actually have a theory that I was thinking about the other day, which is I think teenagers are supposed to hate life.
Yeah.
And that maybe in our society, we've gone into this thing of like, oh, you know, you're depressed. And obviously that can be a thing. Mm. But also it's like, I do think it's part of the teenage experience just to be like, everything is shit. Yeah. Everyone is shit. The world is shit. I'm like, let them wear the dark eyeliner, be angry about things. Now, like, listen to young blood. I think that's what teenagers do. I'm like, get angry.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's the growing pains of kind of going through from childhood to adolescence and then adulthood. And, you know, you're kind of, although you're not there yet, you're sort of steering in that direction. And so, you know, it's, and the hormones.
And the hormones.
And the fact that you get your heart broken, like, every month, and everything feels like the end of the world. Like, there's a lot to be angry about.
Yeah, that's so true. God, I've really just jumped in. I haven't even introduced you yet, but thank you so much for being here.
Hi, I'm Abby.
This is Abby. Some of you might recognise her from the interwebs. That's where I discovered you. I think on TikTok, like quite a long time ago. Let's say you're a content creator, internet ambassador, charity ambassador.
Yes.
And I would say comedian.
Oh, thank you so much.
Comedian.
I like it when people find me funny because I tell a lot of jokes in a day and about half of them land. So when someone says I'm funny, I'm like, yes, thank you.
No, they're really great. And you have such a unique story. We were chatting before. I was like, I don't even know where we start on this. But actually, teenagehood is a great place to start.
Yes. That's where it all began, really.
Yeah. Tell me, like, who was 15-year-old Abby?
Oh, 15-year-old Abby was, as we were saying earlier, so angry at the world. Yeah, 15-year-old Abby was just like, she was punk rock in every sense of the word, like looks wise, but mostly like, I hated authority, hated the system. So I felt very like held down by authority. And I was like, you can't control me. I just wanted to rebel and scream and shout at everyone. I'm still like that now, but I can control it because I'm an adult. And
and you have to live in society.
Yeah, exactly. Teenage Abby, very angry at the world. I had a lot of like, I had my own mental health issues quite early on. Mm. I, as a teenager, really hated myself. Really, really hated myself. Mm. It wasn't the way that I looked. I didn't have like self-image issues. I hated like my soul, like my core, who I was as a person. Like I felt that I was like inherently broken. I was like really defective. I was like inferior to everyone. And yeah, I kind of yeah, I just fostered this really intense self-loathing, like from a young age, and I kind of just grew up that way.
Do you know where that came from?
I think so. As with most of these kind of things, it's all childhood trauma, isn't it?
Attachment theory. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So I lost my father to suicide when I was about 3 years old. It was like, ooh, what year was it? It must have been 91 or something. So like mental health as a concept was not talked about at all. And my dad went through a period of depression and he took his own life. He was like in his mid-40s. That's talked a lot about nowadays.
Yeah.
But it wasn't at the time. So, you know, he did have some help, but there wasn't like the sort of resources that we have now to take care of him. Mm. And then that was really the beginning of all my problems. Yeah, thanks, Dad.
Yeah, that'll get going, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So that really damaged me, you know, like the suicide of a parent, of like one of your primary caregivers, you know, that's going to really mess you up. And then also afterwards, like my dear old mum, I have three siblings. Mm. So, God bless her, you know, she lost her husband, left with these three kids. So she kind of went into survival mode and just kept on going, you know, she just went on kind of like autopilot, get us to school, make sure we're fed, clothed, whatever. Mm. But, you know, she didn't have the headspace or the knowledge to, you know, think, oh, these kids have lost their father. They might be a little bit screwed up. I better, you know, get them some counselling or something before they all grow up into emotionally stunted adults. And so we just never spoke about him again.
Wow.
Really? Yeah. Never spoke about him again. Like, gradually over the years, his kind of pictures came down from the walls. There was never any of like, your dad would be so proud of you. Or we never spoke about him. Like, it wasn't like, oh, your dad would have done this or your dad would have loved this or something, you know? We never saw his grave. We never celebrated his birthday, nothing like that. So he was kind of like erased.
Do you think that's because it was too painful? Like, she hadn't unpacked it herself. So it was like too painful for her to talk about him as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was really painful for her. But then I also think there was a lot on her plate, you know, raising four young children. Because I was the youngest. I was three. My sister was the eldest. She was 13 at the time. And then there's two boys between us. So, you know, I think she was, just in survival mode trying to raise this family. Mm. So, you know, where's the time?
Yeah.
And also, you know, there was, like we were saying before, mental health was not kind of in the mainstream conversation at the time. So there wasn't like, oh, okay, hold on, let's make sure we're grieving. Let's get in touch with our emotions and try and process this in a healthy way. Yeah. Like 1991, no. Like it was, it was just keep calm and carry on in the most British way possible.
Yeah, which, you know, works for a period of time, but then in your teenage years, as you said, in your words, like being emotionally kind of repressed from that situation, you then find ways that are less healthy to cope.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's it. Like, I kind of feel like emotional avoidance was sort of taught to me, not intentionally, but taught to me from a very young age. Like, it was sort of, if you're feeling something difficult or something uncomfortable, you don't confront it, you don't feel it, you block it out, you ignore it, you avoid it at all costs.
Right.
That obviously has its repercussions, and especially for children and teenagers, you know. I grew up very detached from myself emotionally, which is where a lot of the self-hatred came from, a lot of the shame came from, because I just never confronted myself really or felt what it was like to be me or got to know myself or anything like that, because I was just, in complete separation from who I was.
Right. And then you start discovering alcohol, which, as we were saying, like most people in the UK, like, obviously not, it has been so normalized that like teenagers drink. Like, mm-hmm. I remember drinking WKDs like down the park when we were probably, I don't know, maybe like 13. And now, the other day I actually saw this kid vaping, and he, young boys, you can never tell how old they are. It's like, he could be 15, he could literally be 9 years old. Like, I honestly couldn't tell in between. But there was this young kid like vaping, and me and my husband were like, oh God, I can't believe he's so young and he's vaping. Then we were both like, oh, we actually used to smoke like, we smoked like Benson and Hedges when we were like 14, 13.
Yes, it's easy to forget that.
It's so easy to forget.
How we were like the same. Exactly, yeah, the same as the kids.
Was that like where your journey with addiction, did that start like in your teenage years, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Like my, I had the same sort of kind of relationship to binge drinking as pretty much like every teenager in this country.
Yeah.
Binge drinking was expected. It's what we did. It was like allowed pretty much because it was part of the culture. So yeah, I started drinking to begin with, like quite normally with my friends down the park, a few ciders on a park bench, like on a Friday night. But I do remember kind of noticing quite quickly when I was in my early teens that I drank differently to my friends.
Right.
So they would, I don't know, you know, have a few drinks, get a little bit wild. But as soon as I started drinking, I found it very, very, very difficult to stop. Yeah, I kind of took it to the extreme. So like, I don't know, when my friends would be like, okay, it's time to go home now, I would be like going home and raiding my mum's liquor cabinet and like chugging like Christmas sherry or something.
I've all been there.
Because like, I don't know, I feel like, first of all, I know now as an adult and as someone in recovery that I was drinking alcoholically. Even if I wasn't like addicted to alcohol at that point, I was. Right. It's that kind of like, give me more kind of mindset.
Yeah.
This has changed the way I feel, so give me more. Or this is making me feel good, so I'm going to keep on doing this until I am not awake anymore.
Mm-hmm. And avoid the crash, right? Yeah. Like if you black out or you fall asleep, you're putting off the crash for like another 9-12 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it just it made me forget that I hated myself. Really. You know, it was a perfect distraction. I loved getting drunk. I loved hanging out with my mates. Mm-hmm. I loved the way it made me feel. I just loved like not feeling like me. Like being in that drunken haze where, you know, you're not inside of yourself. I loved that. And just once I got started, like it made me feel good. So there was no way I was going to stop until I either passed out or fell asleep. And so it escalated quite quickly.
This maybe is a bit of a side tangent, but I think so many people will relate to that idea of like a little bit of a detachment from yourself, or like enjoying the way that alcohol makes you feel. Like it's why, you know, if people are nervous, like they might have a few drinks when they go into a bar, and it can so quickly turn into a crutch without you really even realizing. Like even those like couple of drinks every time you go into a bar, like for some people that might be that it's the only way they can do it, because it's the only way they feel comfortable enough in themselves to be in that moment. Were you aware at that age? You were like, okay, this is not like how, as you say, not how your friends are doing it, not maybe the socially acceptable side of binge drinking anymore.
I think I noticed it, but like I wasn't alarmed by it. I was just like, I'm having fun. Woohoo.
Yeah.
I noticed that I was drinking differently, but it wasn't something that alarmed me, because I was like, oh, okay, maybe this is just the way that I have to live. You know, as a teenager, I wasn't like, I better stop this, otherwise I'm going to turn into an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I just kind of like, oh, okay. This helps me cope. So I'll just keep on doing this. I'll just keep on drinking. I think when I did sort of realize that maybe I was drinking in an unhealthy way was when I moved out of home, and I was probably in my early 20s, and I would drink a lot at home.
Right.
Nobody I knew did that. Like I would drink every evening at home. because, you know, I was a young adult and I was living in a house with some random people I met. I had lots of,
you want.
Yeah, I had lots and lots of freedom. Like, it blew my mind when I just realized I could go to the shop and I was like, I bought a small bottle of vodka and some Pringles. And I was like, oh, this is my dinner. I can do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, sitting at home with my salt and vinegar Pringles and my bottle of vodka, I'm like, okay, maybe this isn't like what everyone else is doing. But I didn't really care because I was like, oh, this helps me cope. This helps me interact with the world, and this helps me function and not collapse in on myself like a dying star. Like, and then so I accepted it, and I kind of, I was still having a lot of mental health issues at this time as well, like struggling with depression and and then also the self-loathing was very much still there. And I guess I just resigned myself to the fact that I was a depressed drunk, and that was my lot in life, and that's just how I had to live. And so I just kind of facilitated my life around that.
Right. Just like a level of acceptance of like, that's it.
Yeah.
When did drugs get thrown into the mix out of interest?
Oh, also like when I moved to London when I was 18. Actually, no, that's a lie. Right. So I got expelled from school, surprise, surprise. And I went to a local college to do my A-levels, and it was in a place called Bracknell, which has the nickname Crack Hell. So I went to Crack Hell College, and it lived up to its name. Like, my first week being at that college, I was doing my first bumps of cocaine underneath the stairwell before media studies class. I was like, oh, okay, that's why they call it Crack Hell. So I think by that point, you know, if someone was like, here, would you like to try these drugs? I was like, yes, absolutely. Mm. Another thing to help me change the way I feel. I was also in a mindset that I was like, oh, I need to party all the time. Like, this is how I feel alive. Like, this is the only way I can feel alive is if I'm partying. So I was just, it started there. And then I would never say no to drugs if they were offered. And I always surrounded myself with people who had drugs on them.
Yeah. Do you think that like it's an innate, I mean, there's probably shitloads of research about this that maybe you know, or I could definitely look up. But I think, I wonder if there's like an innate difference between people who are like, you know, people say I have an addictive personality and people who don't. Because I see it even in like my husband, like he has such an addictive personality of like, if like we buy weed, which is very rare, or we have a weed pen, like in America, he will use it like every single day until it's gone. And whereas I, like, even though I've done, sorry, mum, if you're listening, like way more drugs than Chris ever has, I never had that like compulsion, I guess. Do you think it's like an innate thing that like you either have that like addictive personality or you don't?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, there'll be environmental factors as well as kind of like personality factors. But I think some people have a much more pronounced off switch.
Right.
Like, I don't have an off switch. And that's with everything. That's with alcohol, that's with drugs, but it's also with coffee, it's with CrossFit, it's with watching cartoons, you know. I won't just watch one cartoon. I'll spend 6 hours watching cartoons.
Right, okay.
Like, if something is altering my mood and it feels good, no matter what that is, I just want more. I want more and more and more. I don't have an off switch. Sugar as well, another one. Like, you know, if there's a box of donuts, I won't have one donut. I must finish them all.
Right.
I must finish them all. I think there's
innate, like,
and then,
a personality trait or something.
Yeah.
So interesting to know that. If anyone has any knowledge on that, let us know.
Yeah.
But so you're doing this and you're living in London, and then I guess the next part of your journey, from what I've read, you end up somewhere where people would presume is like young person heaven, like you're in Thailand, right? You move to Thailand or you travel there and decide to stay?
I traveled to Thailand, but I came across Laos and I ended up being in Laos for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically what had happened was, I, in my early 20s, I was a DJ.
That's cool.
Right. Yeah, because I wanted to do lots of drugs and have sex with a lot of people. So I was like, what's a job where I can do that? And I was going out all the time anyway. Yeah. So I became a DJ. I guess I was in Camden a lot. And so, yes, I was very much like on the scene and kind of fell into that. So I made like, I did that for 2 or 3 years and I made like quite a bit of money. I guess I must have been 23 where I just felt this pull to leave London. I guess I wanted another distraction to stop me feeling right. a certain way. Mm. Or maybe I just wanted to, you know, have a change of scenery, but I felt this pull to leave. And so I was like, okay, what do I do here? Book a one-way ticket to Bangkok.
Of course. What else would you do?
Exactly. And I think in my mind, I was like, oh, maybe like a 6-month trip or something. Mm. And that turned into 4 years. and then the rest. I did like 4 years living in Laos, but then I did another like 6 years of traveling and working holiday visas on top of that.
Right. And did the addiction and that kind of compulsion to not have an off switch, as you say, that came with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, throughout my life, I've not now, obviously, because I'm sober and I'm healed enough that I know what's healthy for me. But, you know, back in the day, I would surround myself with people in places where there were a lot of drugs and there was a lot of like hedonistic behavior. And when I went traveling, I kind of fell into that, you know, and that it was because of all the underlying issues. I didn't want to face what I was feeling, you know. Yeah. I wanted to run away from myself. And traveling around Southeast Asia was a really easy way to do that, you know, because I didn't have to face up to the way I was feeling. I could just drink more, travel to another place, you know.
Yeah.
I was always meeting new people. I got to indulge in all the sex and drugs and wild Bangkok nights that I wanted to. I was like meeting transient people. I was a transient person. There was no one keeping an eye on me saying, oh, maybe you're burning your life to the ground. Like, you know.
Maybe do some therapy. Like, as you say, when you're traveling, like people are so in and out of your life. Like you can make a best friend and then 4 months later they're gone. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're reinventing, I guess.
Yeah. And then my Instagram was all like pictures of me on the beach. But, you know, my mental health problems followed me wherever I went.
Yeah.
You know, there's that phrase, like, wherever you go, there you are. You know, I wanted to be on the move all the time, so I was distracted from, like, the way I felt. But I was always there. I was still living with myself.
Did you not have, like, because when I was traveling in Southeast Asia, I don't think I even smoked weed, and which was, like, for me at that point, like, very unusual, like, to not be doing any drugs. But I was just so shit scared of, like, ending up in a fucking Thai prison or something for like 30 years. Did you not have that fear?
No. And I think it's because I didn't care if I lived or died at the time.
Right. Okay.
You know, like my mental health was like pretty poor. I wasn't looking after myself at all. I didn't really value myself. Also, I think I was just like, I thought I was a rock star. I was like, fuck the system. It was that punk rock Abby still who just wanted to like rage everywhere. And so I didn't really care what happened to me. So, you know, when someone was like, would you like to try this crystal meth when I was living in Laos? I was like, oh, certainly, I'd love to.
Yeah.
Pass me that pipe. Looks delicious.
Yeah. that's the crazy thing about your story is that like, I think people often have an image of like what someone who does like hard drugs looks like or who they are. And obviously like you're so bubbly and like you look healthy and like, you know, just a great person to be around. And it's like, there's that, like, this is not like, oh, your fun London, like a bit of cocaine in the nighttime. Like not to say to diminish that because obviously it often leads to addiction. But this was like fucking like hardcore, as you say, like crystal meth and stuff that generally you're like, okay, the line is drawn before that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when it comes to addiction or, you know, just substance abuse, like people abuse substances mostly because they're absolutely depressed and they don't want to be inside their own skin. And so that could happen to anyone. I managed to get into hard drugs because I purposefully surrounded myself with people who did hard drugs. Although actually, you know, I think these things scout you out sometimes, though, because the guy who gave me crack for the first time, I smoked crack with for the first time, was when I was living in Canada and I was working at this fast food restaurant and it was my boss and he was the most lovely, kind person and he was just on crack the whole time. And then I found out like months later that he was a crack addict and he was like, "Would you like some crack?" And I was like, "Oh, yes. Don't mind if I do." But, you know, it's anyone can be on it. You know, I guess if you're become accustomed to that lifestyle, you really can find a way to function. And it becomes like just something that's integral to your survival or integral to you functioning. So like, you know, a lot of people maybe need a few coffees throughout the day. Very quickly when you're doing hard drugs, it becomes quite normalized. So, you know, rather than, "Oh, I just need a few coffees to get myself through this day." It's like, "Oh, I just need a few hits on this crack pipe." And you just normalize it for yourself and you justify it. And you're like, "Oh, I need this to carry on." Yeah. And it becomes normal. And then it only becomes a problem when, you know, you end up in a psych ward or you end up like homeless or, you know, that's when it kind of like hits home and it's like, "Oh, I'm already quite far into this."
What was the catalyst for you of being like, "Okay, actually I do need to, like, something has to change or I'm going to end up in a ditch or missing," or like, what was that for you?
I had like a year of rock bottoms. Best year ever. But I'd fallen in love with this American guy and I moved to the States to be with him. And when I met him, I was a fully fledged alcoholic. And I was doing a lot of drugs and I was very, very depressed when I met him. But I met him in Laos, in fact, and I was convinced that he'd fixed me.
Right.
I had all the lovely dopamine from falling in love and I was like, "Oh my God, this man has fixed me." And so I was doing quite well for a while. Really, it was just a plaster over a huge gaping wound. But yeah, I was doing really well mentally because I turned this man into another drug. And he made me feel very good. But of course, that didn't last. So I moved to New York to live with him. And then, you know, by that time, I was kind of coming down from the high. And it became very apparent that I wasn't just this nice British backpacker hippie kind of chick. I was a very depressed drunk, and when I was left alone in his house while he went to work, I would help myself to his tequila and I became like an absolute mess, like this like crazy person to be around. Like he would come home from work and I would just be like in a rage, drunk, like blackout drunk. I remember like points of me just like screaming at him, and you know, I was an active alcoholic. You know, you can, we're difficult to live
yeah.
with.
Yeah,
it's okay when we're in recovery, but when we're actively drinking, you know, living with alcoholics and loving an alcoholic is very, very difficult. So I was just unhinged, out of control, and yeah, he broke up with me. Of course, because, you know, I was kind of destroying his life. Like, his housemates were like, "Hey, dude, who's this drunk British chick that's in our living room? Why is she here?"
Right.
She's
Oh, he lived
like,
with other people as well.
Yeah. Perhaps.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. And they were like, "Dude, you have to, like, leave the house. Like, either you or her has to go."
Yeah.
And then, so he, he broke up with me. And then this is how it happened. I had a visa for Canada to do a working holiday visa in Canada. So in the middle of the night, he packed up, like after I'd had a tequila session, and I was flying off the handle for whatever reason, he like threw all my stuff in a bag, put it in the car, drove me to Newark Airport in the middle of the night, and then put me on a plane to Canada.
Wow.
And that was one rock bottom because I really, really loved him. Mm. And it really, I really hurt myself in that situation because I'd completely destroyed something that was really precious to me.
Right.
And I hated myself for that. And I felt a lot of shame. Mm. Like, this was all my own doing. Like, it was all my own actions. And I found that so difficult to live with.
Mm.
And then I went to Canada and I was in crisis, really, to be honest. Like, my family was so far away, but I was in crisis mode. Like, I really needed to be looked after. But I was very far away from everyone who would have looked after me. So, shipped me off to Canada. And that's where I met my crack friend, my cracky boss.
Okay, cracky boss.
Yeah, I was in that. I was so depressed, angry, heartbroken, full of shame. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't want to be around anymore. I didn't care about myself. I didn't care if I lived or died. So he was like, "Do you want some crack?" I was like, "Yes, I will." Yeah. Literally, I would inject heroin into my eyeballs right now if you offered it to me. Mm. And then that was a really horrible few months being on crack.
Yeah, one reports it being a good time.
Yeah, it was really horrible. I went on this like almighty binge, and I didn't sleep for a long time.
Wow.
It was horrible. I was sick. I wasn't eating. I was hardly sleeping. I was just waking up, smoking crack, falling asleep. Look, the only thing I would eat was like chicken wings would get delivered to our house every now and then. Mm. So I was so unhealthy. My mental health was shot.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, do you know what will make this better? If I move somewhere else, that'll do it. Yeah. That'll make me feel better. So I moved to British Columbia on Vancouver Island, and I got a job in a barbecue restaurant, and I was really full on in self-destruct mode. It went all, my job at this barbecue restaurant went well for maybe like a month.
Mm.
And then my drinking got out of hand. I was away from the crack. That was great.
Yeah.
But I was on this war path, I guess, of self-destruction. So I just doubled my drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. I'd go to work. I would immediately go behind the bar and just pour myself a glass of vodka. I pretty much didn't care anymore. I would just get rat-assed. And I ended up having a suicide attempt myself.
Right.
I was living in this trailer and I was drinking so much. My mental health was really terrible, but I think because I was drinking so much that I made the attempt.
Mm.
So I was plastered. And then I ended up in like a psych ward in Canada on Vancouver Island. I'd just gotten wasted, tried to kill myself, and then like my roommate at the time came home and was like, "Ah, my god!"
Yeah,
called the police, and so I got sectioned. But that wasn't a wake up call at all,
which it usually isn't, right? Like, this is, I guess, the thing with addiction is that people often, it's like how you go through cycles and cycles and cycles, right? And like maybe you start to think that things might change, and then often people relapse. And like, how do you get to that point then? Like, now you've been sober. How long have you been sober? Like
five years.
5 years.
Yeah.
What is the final thing that actually like changes or gets you that last time when you become sober and it sticks?
I was finally forced to go home and face up to my mess.
Right.
Basically. Okay. COVID hit.
Mm.
So I got out of the psych ward and I went straight to the liquor store, carried on my ways. I'd ended up losing my job as well because I was drunk, like blackout drunk at work, tried to shag my boss, and then tried to get him to give me a drug dealer's number, I think. It's a bit hazy.
Yeah. But he wasn't like employee of the month.
Yeah, exactly. He was not impressed.
No.
Fired me. And that's when COVID hit. And they were like, I was living in like a tourist town. All the other backpackers there were all flying home.
Mm.
Nobody knew what was going on. Everything was so uncertain. So everyone else in the town was flying home. So I was like, oh, I guess I should go home. Like, what's happening in the world? And I flew back to the UK. Like, I had no intentions of going back to the UK. I just wanted to travel the world and run away from myself for the rest of my life. Like, yeah. I was going to carry on this self-destruction spree until I died, pretty much. But COVID forced me to go home. I moved back in with my mum. And I think it was something about being in my childhood home where I'd experienced like so much trauma like through my childhood and my teenage years and being there held up a mirror to me, I think. And I became really reflective about what a mess I'd made of my life and just how miserable I was, you know?
Yeah.
And I had a few days of like lamenting on that and I think something switched in me where I kind of realized that I didn't actually want to die, and that maybe if I had to do this whole life thing, then maybe I shouldn't be so depressed all the time, and maybe it would be kind of cool if I was happy.
Yeah.
And I think like I was like, oh, maybe I do deserve to be happy. Maybe I do deserve to have good things and just have like a normal life where I'm not destroying myself all the time. And then I remember I was sat on my childhood bed, like surrounded by like my childhood stuff, like a Furby and a Game Boy, Pokemon cards and stuff, and like something just kind of like clicked in me. I didn't get sober like immediately when I got home. I did some like drinking at home, you know. In my bedroom, I was still kind of like drinking vodka like I had done as a teenager.
Yeah.
But after I think a solid week of drinking, that's when I kind of like just heard a little voice in my head that kind of like said, like, it doesn't have to be this way. Like, you don't have to live this way. Like, there is a different way and you can change. Like, I always felt so powerless. Like, it was all... like I was destined to be this depressed drunk and I didn't have any choice and I just had to go along with it. But for the first time, I kind of felt like I had some agency over my life and I could make a choice to stop living that way. And I did. Like in that moment, I said yes. I could have easily said no.
Yeah.
And I was so vulnerable at the time. I'm surprised I didn't. But something in me was just screaming, like, say yes. And then... everything sort of slotted into place, and I realized that, you know, I was ill, but I also realized that one of the common factors in all my problems was the fact that I couldn't stop drinking.
Yeah.
And that I was powerless to alcohol. Mm. And alcohol was like, it was destroying me, but also I couldn't live without it. And it was such a huge part of my life. And I realized that all it ever really, like, given me was hell.
Yeah.
And I was like, hold on.
This thing that was fun is now just fucked the last, like, 10 years of your life.
Yeah. I was like, why did I sign up to this? And it just made perfect sense, you know, that alcohol was the thing that was destroying me. I mean, I was destroying myself, but, like, alcohol was the thing that was facilitating it. And I had no power over it. I had no control. I couldn't stop drinking. So it became very clear to me that if I wanted to be happy, if I wanted to enjoy my life, then I couldn't bring alcohol with me. I'd have to leave it behind.
Yeah. It sounds like you almost like you found a new, I guess, appreciation for yourself, but also for life, like for being alive.
Definitely. Definitely.
Which maybe you hadn't had since you were even a kid.
Yeah. I think I began to be like, I think I found self-compassion and I was able to be compassionate with myself for the first time. You know, I mean,
your fucking dad like took his own life when you were 3 years old. It's like anyone on the outside would be like, yeah, like that's going to fuck you up. Like, of course. But if you've just buried that and buried it and internalized it on yourself and been like, oh, this is like a me problem. Like I must be the thing that's like bad in this situation. It's like, it's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah, which is why I think like being in my childhood home was kind of what initiated this kind of like awakening, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, because I guess I was in tune with the younger version of me who wasn't so much pain and who had experienced so much trauma. And I think I was able to be compassionate with that younger version of me in that moment. You know, that inner child healing.
Yeah, yeah, it's powerful stuff.
Yeah, and I think, I guess I just thought, oh my God, you deserve better.
Yeah.
You poor little child. Like, you don't, like, you need, like, you need looking after, you need protecting, and you need someone to be nice to you. Like, oh no, that's me.
Yeah.
I'm the person who needs to be nice to me.
Yeah, 100%. Because ultimately, like, you know, you're in the vessel that you're in, and as much as, like, you can seek that kindness from family or friends or often partners, like, it doesn't work if internally you're, like, feeling like you're rotting yourself.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
One thing I actually really want to ask, because I have such complex feelings about this with my party self, like, if I meet someone from the years where I used to take loads of drugs and party, I almost have, like, I don't want to say PTSD because that's a real diagnosis, but I almost have, like, a, like, oh God, I want people to really know that, like, I'm not that version of myself anymore. How do you, like, resolve that? Like, that you're now, well, do you see yourself now as a really different person, or is it an evolution of yourself?
I think I definitely see myself as a completely different person. I think, yeah, the evolution has been, like, quite pronounced. You know, I've had the same group of friends since I was 20 years old. And I've done a lot of partying with them, but, you know, they have loved me through it all, through everything. You know, even when we've been in different countries, I've had the same group of friends who have always been part of my life. And so, you know, they were the friends, you know, I did a lot of partying with them, but I think nowadays, because the evolution has been so huge and so pronounced, that when I'm hanging out with them, I don't feel like it's drinking me. I feel like, you know, they've been there for every step of the way.
Yeah.
They've been there for crazy, good time, drunk Abby. They've been there for off a rocker on drugs Abby, but they've also been there for healthy, healed, stable Abby as well. Like, they know all those parts of me. I don't hang out with the people who I used to do hard drugs with anymore.
Yeah.
I don't spend time with people that, that I found myself in dark places with.
That's so interesting, because I was just thinking, like, in my head I was like, oh, that's so shocking that you have those people who've gone through you. And then I'm like, actually, like, three of my closest friends are exactly the same. And it's like, you often hear the stories, you say, about cutting off the people who are the friends who are the party people, but that's their sole role. But then you still have these people whose actual role is, like, to look after your soul and be with you that whole journey.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nice that you have them.
Yeah. I think I was the toxic one, to be honest. And they were the patient, kind ones. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I had I continue to have a lot of support from my friends.
And then you're living and you're healthy, in your words, and you've got your mental health, like, more under control at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, you know, the first couple of years of sobriety was great.
Yeah.
They call it the pink cloud. I don't know if you've come across
that.
Like, the pink cloud is early sobriety, where everything's amazing. You found this new lease of life. You're healthy. Your mind's changing. You're learning. And you've got the buzz of, like, being in recovery and being sober. You float on that cloud for as long as you can, but, you know, what comes up must come down.
Right.
So eventually the pink cloud does wear off. My pink cloud lasted for 2 years, I think.
Okay.
And then I had a massive breakdown.
Right.
You know, everything caught up with me. You know, I was still living with all the reasons why I drank, but I wasn't drinking anymore. So I still had all the self-loathing, the depressive stints. I didn't have my main coping mechanism anymore.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how to cope, and I wasn't coping, and I had this, like, full-on breakdown, and it was just, like, so confusing, because I was like, I'm sober now, but I'm, like, I'm having a nervous breakdown. Like, what is going on? Like, I was working a normal job, and I almost lost my job, and I'm like, how am I still losing jobs in sobriety? And that encouraged that experience, because I was in a dark place. That experience encouraged me to seek mental health support, because I was like, right, I got myself out of this.
Yeah.
I'm not going back into that place, and I'm not doing this whole thing over again. I was like, I am out of the chaos. I respect myself. I love myself. I've made this commitment to to be kind to myself. I'm not going back to that dark place. So, yeah, I sought out mental health support from like my local services.
Wow.
And then I basically called up every mental health service and said, hello, I'm having a breakdown. What can I do?
Yeah.
And I called up so many places and I told them my history and everything that I'd been through and, you know, like being sectioned and all my struggles. And I finally got through to the right people. I got through to a personality disorder department.
Hmm.
And they invited me in for a 6-week mental health assessment.
Okay.
And then I had that assessment. And they were like, yeah, well, you've definitely got borderline personality disorder.
Right.
And I was like, okay, cool.
For people who don't know what that is, can you give it a little spiel?
Yeah. So borderline personality disorder is where one of the main like symptoms is complete emotional dysregulation. You have very, very intense emotions, but your sense of self is so disconnected that you're not able to regulate them. You're not able to self-soothe. Your emotions are heightened, like times a million.
Mm.
But you don't have the tools.
Yeah.
To be able to bring yourself down to earth. You know, substance abuse is so common with people with borderline personality disorder because, you know, your emotions are so intense and you don't know. you can't
regulate them.
Yeah.
So you need something external sometimes to regulate them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got I got diagnosed with that. And then I went on a intensive course of therapy, which helped me so much.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, for the first time I was actually treating, like, I don't know, I was being treated for something that was causing me pain. And I was doing a course called mentalization-based therapy, which is an intensive therapy where you're in a group setting, but you also have individual therapy.
Mm.
Mentalization would be described as like thinking about your thoughts.
Okay.
So it's basically teaching you emotional regulation, but in a more kind of like abstract way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all done through kind of like the relationships you have with the people who are also doing group therapy with you.
Okay.
So you kind of go through a BPD journey with a group of other people who also have BPD, but then you also work with an individual therapist as well. And that helped me so much.
Mm.
Like, so much.
Is this the first therapy you've done in your whole journey?
Yeah. Yeah, that's big time.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But also crazy that, like, you got to that with without anyone kind of forcing you. Like, I remember the first time I did, well, I actually did child therapy, but that's a whole other story. But the first time I did it was like at university because my professor was like, we think you're depressed. And I was like, I'm just having a really fun time. Thank you, Dr. Andrew Glenister. But he was like, no, you need to go to therapy. But that's kind of wild that you got the whole way through this without anyone almost forcing you into that.
Yeah, I think I was just white knuckling my way through life and, you know, having this external facade of being this good time party girl because I'm quite a bubbly person.
Yeah,
I'm quite like good at masking my bad or my difficult feelings.
Mm.
You know, and so I think it alarm bells didn't ring for people because I was drunk all the time.
Yeah, and they're so probably like, "Well, she's fun to be around," and like,
yeah, but really, I was dying inside.
Okay, so you're having therapy and it's like revolutionary, it sounds like, for you.
Yeah.
And you're kind of healing yourself, you're healing your core, right?
Yeah.
What does life look like at this point? Are you like,
oh, I'm going up in the world.
Yeah.
You know, nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
Because, you know, no matter how like better I get at coping with my mental illness and then also my bouts of depression, you know, I do get better at coping with them, but they still happen.
You know?
So life's not perfect, but doing well.
Mm.
Got a new job. I started going to a new gym. Shagged one of the coaches.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Moved in with him. Yeah. Tricked him into moving in with me.
Did you get free sessions?
No.
Sorry, that's so rude.
I know, right? But now we're a couple. I do.
Okay, now you do.
Now he does lots of
programming. But he was like, I want to lock this down before I give any free time away.
Exactly.
Yeah, fair.
I meet Steph and we fall in love across the gym. We move in together. I'm working for a creative agency. He's working at the gym. We move in together. We've got a flat. We're, building a life together. You know, I'm stable. This man's amazing. Mm. Like he's very empathetic man. He has always taken the time to kind of understand me, and he's very patient. he's very caring. And so, yeah, we're building this life together. Everything's fantastic. Mm. I'm like, so the therapy course I was doing was 18 months. I think I was about 8 months into it. And then I started getting migraines, which I've never had before. Never had migraines, only hangovers. But they're like not like any sort of headache I'd ever had. So I was waking up at like 3 o'clock in the morning with a pounding migraine and then running to the bathroom and throwing up.
Wow.
Like immediately.
That's shocking in the middle of the night.
And this was happening regularly, like a few times a week.
Wow.
When it did start happening, before it was happening regularly, like it would be like, every few days. And then I went to see the doctor, and my GP diagnosed me with sinusitis because I had a lot of like pressure behind my eyes and in my forehead and stuff. And then they gave me some antibiotics and things were sort of getting better, but like the migraines were taking over my life, basically. Like I was performing really poorly at work because I wasn't sleeping and I had headaches all the time. And I'd kind of go to see the GP and they'd look at me and be like, oh yeah, no, you'll be okay. Here's some more antibiotics. See if we can get rid of the sinusitis and stuff.
Right.
And then, it was horrible. I was really struggling, when the headaches started or the migraines started escalating, they ended up being like every night.
Wow.
Every night. And it finally got to the point where I couldn't really see anymore.
Right.
My vision became blurred and I had double vision. And it got to the point where I couldn't even like walk around the house without Steph like leading me like around by the hand. So I went to the optician.
What are you thinking is going on here? Are you just like...
I thought I had sinusitis.
Sorry, quick chat GPT. Sinusitis. Like, I mean, that's... not what you'd expect from sinusitis. And the doctors didn't go like, okay, maybe this is something a bit...
You know what? No. Because they would ask me, they were like, are you waking up in the middle of the night with a migraine and throwing up? And I was like, that's very specific, but yes, I am. And they're like, okay. It's probably sinusitis.
Did they know about your history, actually, of addiction out of interest? No.
No.
So you don't think there was any like weird biases going on of like, well, this is what happens when you fuck your body for that long?
No, they didn't. They didn't know anything like that. I don't know. Maybe they didn't want to worry me or scare me, but I mean, they should have.
Yeah,
because when I ended up going to the opticians, they did a scan of my eyeballs, and then they were like, "Okay, we need to show you the scan." So here's a normal person's eye, and it had like the lens and stuff, and it was like a crisp circle. And they were like, "Here is your eye." And my eye was all like the lens was completely blurry. It was just this blurry blob. And they were like, your optic nerves are so swollen. You have to go to A&E, like eye hospital, right now. Steph came and picked me up because I couldn't see. And then we went to A&E at the eye hospital. Yeah, I got there. And then they did more scans of my eyeballs. Yeah, I remember sitting around and I could overhear the eye doctor on the phone, and I kept on hearing him say the word like neurology and like neuro and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, hold on, that's your head. Like, what?
Because at this point you're thinking like, maybe I'm going blind or like my eyes are fucked or...
Yeah. Maybe I just have sinusitis.
this sinusitis is a real bad one.
Yeah, the doctors told me it was sinusitis, they're sure. So, you know, I was kind of like, I wasn't panicking, but I was just like, that doesn't sound great.
Yeah.
And then, they were like, you need to go to St. Mary's right now. You need to go to A&E. They're expecting you. And I was like, oh, boy. So we got there. Had a CT scan, and in the morning they were like, there's a mass in your brain. They were like, yeah, it's probably a tumor. Being honest with you, it's probably a tumor. And then I remember the doctor, Dr. Ryan, he was really nice to me. I remember him so well. He was like, we can't tell from just the scan, but there's a good chance it's malignant.
Fuck.
And I was like, oh, God. And he was like, do you know what malignant means? And I was like, yes, Ryan, I know what malignant means. I was like, it's not good. He was like, no, it's not good. And then he was, and he told me, he was like, you need to have brain surgery in like a day.
This is so, like within, what, 24, 48 hours of being at the optician?
I went for the optician's appointment on Monday morning. On Wednesday morning, I was being wheeled into the operating room to have brain surgery.
Fuck.
Yeah. Everything was happening so fast.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really, like, have time to stop and go, like, oh, whoa, this is a bit intense.
Yeah.
I kind of just, like, went along with everything. So I had the first brain surgery.
Are you awake for the brain surgery?
No.
Because you do get some when they do it when you're awake.
Yeah, sometimes
they
do. I was asleep, thank God.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, when I went in for my first brain surgery, they were like, the anaesthetist came around and she was like, oh, okay, so this is what's going to happen when you get operated on. And I was like, can I just tell you that I'm a recovering drug addict? I was like, I prefer it if I didn't have any drugs. And she was like, you're going to need the drugs. And I was like, actually. She was like, it's fine. You're not at a party.
Yeah.
She was like, it's not a rave. It's not like recreational. Like, you're just going to fall asleep. And I was like, okay. I remember being in like the room that they anaesthetize you in.
Yeah.
And then like as soon as they injected me, they were like, oh, this is something that will make you feel good. And I remember they did it. And I remember thinking, oh, that's ketamine.
Oh,
and then,
wow.
And then I remember my eyes rolling back in my skull. And then the next thing I remember is waking up.
How old are you at this point when you get your diagnosis or when you get this surgery?
36.
Fuck.
Yeah, so I got sober at 32. Had 4 years of, well, had 2 years of rockiness, 2 years of joy, and then boom.
Yeah. I remember seeing this on your Instagram because I discovered you when you were probably, I think you were probably in the good years of like, things seemed to be going really well. You were like going to the gym, doing all this stuff. But sharing these quite funny stories of like the darkness, but told in a really funny way. And I remember seeing this story and being like, sorry. I was like, is this the same account? I was like, is this the same account that she's having brain surgery? Yeah. Like, what the fuck has happened?
Yeah.
Like, this is not the plot line that we were expecting.
No, absolutely not. It really came out of the blue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had that first brain surgery and they took a biopsy of the tumour. They knew it was a tumour at this point.
Right.
There was a cyst next to the tumour, actually, that was filling with liquid and growing bigger. Mm. And it was pushing the tumour into my brain, and that's where my symptoms were coming from.
Okay.
I would later find out that the tumour I have is called an oligodendroglioma. And it's like slow growing, like it's really slow. Mm. So, you know, if the cyst wasn't there, I might even today not have known that I had a brain tumour.
Is a cyst related to the tumour?
Yeah.
Right. So it just happened to get a cyst, but you can have them and not have a cyst.
Yeah, I think so.
Fuck.
But yeah, it was filling with liquid, getting bigger, pushing the tumour into my skull. Into my brain, sorry. Yeah. And then that's what was giving me the symptoms. And then, you know, I went home, recovered from my first brain surgery. 2 weeks later, I was, you know, getting back on my feet. And then my new neurosurgeon called me. And he was like, so, got some news. The brain tumor is a lot more aggressive than we first thought. You've got brain cancer. You need to have chemotherapy, radiotherapy, the whole shebang. He was like, you've got full-blown cancer. Like, oh, no.
How do you even, like, I mean, hearing the word cancer is terrifying for anyone at any point in their life, but hearing the word cancer at, like, 36, like, how do you, I mean, how do you even start to wrap your head around that? Or do you not, are you just going into survival, like next step, next step, next step?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, that was, yeah, mostly I'm in survival mode. I'm just doing the next thing. You know, it was a series of challenges and I was just like kind of ticking them off as I go through. But you know what? My initial reaction was like, of course I've got fucking brain cancer. Like, you know, of course this would happen to me. Like, I was like, this is so on brand and dramatic for me. Like, of course I couldn't just get sober and have, I think I was being a bit of a victim.
Well, I mean, fair enough, to be honest.
Yeah, I was like, of course I can't just get sober and have my happy ending. Of course there's got to be one more thing to put a spanner in the works. Like, I just wasn't shocked. I was like, you know, if that was going to happen to anyone, it was going to happen to me.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, it was just, a case of just taking each day as it came. And each day came with a new medical drama to deal with. Yeah. And yeah, it was literally one day at a time. Every morning it just brought something different. And it was just a case of, just knowing that I wanted to keep on moving forward. And so just taking those steps and continuing.
And you've had two surgeries and a shitload of chemo and radio and...
Yeah. I had the two brain surgeries. Then I had IVF, actually.
Did you?
Yeah. Because they were like, you're going to be infertile.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So I went through that little journey.
So now you've got some embryos in the freezer?
Yeah, we've got 5 embryos in a freezer somewhere.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then... I had that, all the hormonal stuff that came with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole journey in itself.
Yeah. And then I had 6 weeks of radiotherapy, which was 5 times a week. It was a full-time job getting my skull zapped. And then 8 months of chemo.
Fuck.
Yeah.
It's like actually being on the couch with you now. It's kind of like with everything that has gone on in your life, it's like shocking that you're in one piece and like... a functioning human being. I don't think many people would have the resilience or like the will to just keep like evolving and taking this and moving forward.
Yeah. Like it astounds me. Like when I look back on everything that's happened, I'm like, how the hell am I still here? How did I get through all that?
Yeah.
And I think like having so many mental health struggles, I think, from a young age, and then my addiction struggles. I think that really built resilience in me big time. And it taught me that I could do hard things and I could get through these challenges, and that there is another side of a challenge. I mean, brain cancer is a pretty big challenge, but I know, I think going through it, I always approached it with a lot of hope because through my mental health struggles and my addiction issues, I did come out on the other side. I was lucky enough to come out on the other side. And so going through cancer, I've just, I have a very hopeful outlook because I'm like, okay, I've been through all that and there was a life after that. So I'm going to go through this and there will be a life for me. Like, you know, it might look different to what I expected or wanted, but I shall adapt and there will be some sort of resemblance of life after this, you know, whole cancer thing.
And even having like the foresight and the ability to in that moment be like, okay, well, if I'm going to be infertile, I'm going to do this IVF. And like, that is such a forward planning thing. So now, do they class you as in remission now? Is that how it works with your
diagnosis? No. So my brain cancer is incurable.
Right. So they don't do any remission. They don't call it that. It's just...
No. They call it stable.
Okay.
That's what they call it.
Right.
So, like, my oncologist, when I got, like, the... when we had the meeting, when they sit you down in a characterless office and say, you have cancer and you're going to die. We had that moment. And, yeah, he was like, okay, so your tumour is incurable. You're going to have it for the rest of your life. You'll probably live for another 15 years. But it is going to be, it's fatal. Like, it's going to kill you one day. Like, we don't know when, you know, have no idea. But, you know, unless you have an accident, this is going to be the thing that kills you, unfortunately. You know, there is no cure. There is no remission. What we can hope for now is that the tumor stays stable and it doesn't grow. I mean, one day it will grow again.
Right.
Brain tumors do, or primary brain tumors do anyway. They always grow back. But yeah, what we're hoping for now is that for as long as possible, it can stay stable. When it starts growing again, I'll have more treatment.
Right. So you don't have to do treatment before then?
No. I have MRIs at the moment every month, and then it'll be like every 6 months. But yeah, they're just going to keep an eye on it. When it starts growing again, they'll give me treatment. Yeah. But for now, like, I just live the most healthy life I can.
Yeah.
Enjoy my life as much as I can. And, you know, like... I have a deep appreciation for my life now. Mm. Yeah, and there will be so many more hurdles. And at some point, hopefully in many, many, many years, I will get sick again. But for now, I'm just, I don't know, live my life as well as possible until then.
Yeah, that's such a massive thing. I mean, we spend so much time on this couch talking about like what we thought our life would be and like dismantling all those ideas. And then does it in a weird way feel like you were kind of on extra time anyway because you never thought you'd get to this because of your addiction? Or does it still, because you then built that new vision of your life, does it still feel like you're I guess having this ginormous thing taken away? Like what is that processing like?
I think you're right. Yeah, I did feel like I was on borrowed time because especially with my mental health issues as well, I spent a lot of my time being suicidal, you know. So, you know, if it wasn't the drugs that killed me, most likely it would have been me that killed me. You know, so I do feel in a way that I was living on bonus time. And, you know, of course, cancer is very disappointing. Like, yeah. I think that's the word that I would, like...
Disappointing.
Yeah, I think that's the word that I would use the most. Like, because, you know, you never know what life's going to throw at you, but you do, or I do anyway, go through life with, like, some sort of hope and, like, you see a future for yourself and you think about being 80 years old and all that. So knowing that that is unattainable... It's really disappointing, but you know, I think when you do have sort of like a timeline, for me anyway, I try not to get too down about it.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I try not to feel sorry for myself. Like, obviously I have times where I feel sad that I'm going to have time taken away from me. But I try not to pity myself or kind of get into that wallowing mode because that's just going to make me feel worse. So it's pretty disappointing because I wanted to live, like, especially because I got my life together.
Yeah, you're like, I finally fucking did it.
Yeah.
And now I've got like the picket fence and the great partner.
Yeah.
And like smashing it at the gym and like lifting and doing all this stuff that you do.
Yeah.
I guess we'll wrap up soon, but how do you then go about planning? Because I know, like, when people say like, oh, it could be, you know, 15 years,
yeah,
you then like hear people who, you know, get way longer or they don't, and like it feels like it's always a bit of a kind of like ballpark in the air, right? They can't tell you exactly. Because some people will be like, oh, well, if I knew I had 15 years to live, I'd go and do this, and I'd do this, and I'd sell all my stuff. But it's like, well, you still have to live.
Yeah.
So it's like, you still have to like support yourself and stuff. How do you then think about like the next 10 years, or do you stay very much in the moment?
I'm staying very, very positive.
Yeah.
Along with the hope, I have been very positive. I have surprised myself, Lydia. Mm. Like, I'm quite like a negative person. Like a bit naturally, I'm a pessimist, and I have to force myself to be optimistic.
Right.
But I've approached
so not how you come across, by the way.
Know.
Like at all.
I just think that when people look at me and how I behave, all bubbly.
Yeah.
I just need to remember there's a teenage punk rocker in there who hates everyone.
That's why you have to wear this outfit, so exactly. People remember. You're like, this is my teenage dressing.
Yeah, she is in there and she's very angry.
Yeah.
So I do have, yeah, I have that negativity in me. I'm a natural pessimist, but I have approached this whole cancer debacle with like positivity.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, that is so not like me. But I think I spent so many years hating myself. Like, I spent so many years being really mean and cruel to myself and treating myself poorly and basically bullying and torturing myself. So yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm not doing that anymore. I am going to use my time that I have left being so nice to myself, being looking forward to my future and being positive. And, you know, I try to live like, I don't know, maybe not everyone would have this approach, but I try and live like I don't have a death sentence. Because, well, it's not a death sentence. It's not an immediate death sentence. So, because like the 15 years isn't based on me as
right.
a person. It's not based on my case. It's based on the diagnosis of a grade 3 oligodendroglioma.
Mm.
So the data that they have worldwide, which is actually really quite old, 15 years is the average.
And also different people getting diagnosed at different age, different
yeah.
health statuses at the beginning, different behaviour mm-hmm. after that. Like, I guess, you know, I definitely don't want to be one of those people, which I imagine is fucking annoying. And you get it all the time where people are like, oh, but you know, you'll do this. Or like, have you tried this thing? Have you tried this thing? But then there is still like, as you said, there is like a level of hope because it is a bit finger in the air of that data.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I asked my oncologist. I don't know if he would have told me otherwise.
Right.
So, because I was like, I was like, tell me, doc. I was really dramatic. I was like, how long have I got left?
So I've seen this in black and white now. And for some reason, you have like one of those old English accents that's like, oh, doctor, tell me what's going to happen to me.
It was exactly like that. Yeah. I asked him and that's what he came out with. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I try to live like I don't have this thing,
yeah.
like hanging over my head, because I think I want to do justice for myself and I want to give myself the best life going forward with whatever time I have left. And I think if I was worrying about this deadline of 15 years and
how would you live?
Yeah, I think I would kind of worry myself into oblivion. And so, you know, It's just another thing that I have to live with. So I feel like I live with my borderline personality disorder. I manage that quite well. I live with my addiction issues,
yeah.
with my alcoholism, which is like, you know, still something I have to deal with every day.
Yeah.
It's a lot quieter than it used to be. It's a lot more manageable, but it's still something I have to deal with every day. And now I've just got a cheeky bit of brain cancer that I have to deal with every day.
Well, at least you got rid of that sinusitis, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Exactly. That cleared right up.
That cleared up. Okay, I'm going to ask one last question, then we'll go into yes or mess. But my last question is around, like, is there a myth or misconception or even, like, a societal expectation tied to this period of your life that you would just like to challenge and throw out completely?
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm 37 now, and I think I thought when I was younger that when I was 37, my life would be set in stone, you know, that I wouldn't have, I don't know, I'd be very settled and stable and everything would be fixed and I'd have a pathway. But I think, you know, you don't enter your 30s and you're like, okay, everything's perfect and I have a happy ending now, you know.
Yeah.
I think, challenges are always going to come, but you can re-evolve. You can go through your 30s and then on with your life, like evolving at any point, changing at any point. Or if you do commit to something, you can change your mind.
Mm.
Like, you know, whether that be career path or a relationship that's not working out for you, you know. I think when I was younger, I thought that you made choices and then you had to stick with those choices.
Mm-hmm.
But I know now that people are always changing and you can go through life changing at any point.
Mm. I love that. Amen to that. Completely yeah. agree. Okay, we're going to finish up with yes or mess, which is this little section that I do where rapid fire questions. And if you're into it, you say yes. And if it's not, you say mess. It sort of feels very trivial after that whole conversation, but we're going to do it.
I love it. It's like a little palate cleanser.
It is a little palate cleanser. Some of them are a bit much though. One, dating someone who drinks when you are sober.
Yes.
Mm.
My partner drinks. Not heavily.
Yeah.
But he does drink.
But it works.
All my friends drink. Well, most of them. So, yes.
Interesting. Having a bucket list?
Yes. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's good to... There are a lot of experiences that I want to have before I die. So, yeah, I really want to go to WrestleMania in the States.
Where's that?
Oh, my God. So, fun fact about me, I'm a huge pro wrestling fan. Like, they do it in a different place each year, but it's basically wrestling Super Bowl. That's on my bucket list.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty, yeah, that's a hell yes.
Yeah. Wrestling's actually amazing. I saw some in Mexico City and I was like, this is actually fucking cool.
The athleticism is incredible. But, you know, paired with the storylines, the drama, the character, the spandex, the ceremony of the thing, like, I love it.
Have you watched, what's that show that was, it had Marc Maron in and it was called like, Glow?
Oh, yeah.
Ladies of Wrestling?
Yeah. No, I never saw it.
But you need to watch it.
It's been on my list for a while.
Okay. I hope to see you in some spandex doing some wrestling on your TikTok. On the note of TikTok, fighting in the TikTok comments, yes or mess?
Oh, mess. Big mess. Ugh.
Fair.
Not that. Yeah. I have to have a word with myself sometimes because I will literally sit there for an hour before I realise that I've been reading through people's comments and reading people arguing in the comments. And I'm like, this is bringing nothing to my life. I'm not actually enjoying it. Actually, no, I do enjoy it a little bit. But like, oh, it just makes me angry. I'm like, why am I doing this to myself?
Yeah, I'm probably one of those people arguing, to be honest. Number four is being open about your past with your employers.
Oh, yes. I think it's really difficult.
Mm.
But yes, like I've always been open.
Yeah.
Mainly because like a lot of my stuff's like medical.
Right.
In terms of like borderline personality disorder diagnosis. But then I guess biases are out there.
Mm.
You know, so.
Biases are real.
But, you know, in the interest of just always being transparent. And I love to overshare. So, yeah.
And the last one, we kind of talked about this. Well, I nudged this before we started filming, but writing a one-woman comedy show about your life.
I mean, maybe one day, yes.
Yeah. I could see that for you. Like a kind of Baby Reindeer-esque, where it's like so fucking dark, but also hilarious.
Yeah.
And then just go to number one on Netflix.
There we go. Easy.
You can have that for free as an idea.
Thank you. That's my next 15 years planned out.
Get busy.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's only brings so much light and humour to something which is fucking tragic. It's a real pleasure to have a conversation around, and I appreciate all your rawness.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
I loved it.
Yay.